me just say, there are periods of time when the stars align for every part of the world. Let's remember that the United States experienced this in the post-war years, right? Coming out of the Depression, World War II, came the largest economy in the world, largest manufacturing center in the world. Europe also had its period where it was able to afford being a welfare state, offering the higher standard of living to a very large number of people like no other part of the world did. Asia also has those stars objectively aligning today.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. That was the voice of Dr. Parag Khanna, founder and managing partner of FutureMap, a data and scenario-based strategic advisory firm based in Singapore. Khanna is a recognized commentator on Asian geopolitics. He appears regularly at global forums, government gatherings, and closed-door briefings. He's also the author of a new book, The Future is Asian: Commerce, Conflict, and Culture in the 21st Century, in which he tries to correct what he sees as an excessive focus on the rise of China in world affairs. The countries of Southeast Asia, he argues, are left in China's shadow, and that, he says, is a failed assessment of the region's potential. I caught up with Parag in Singapore. We sat in a quiet corner of the Members Club 1880 and tucked into the conversation you're about to hear. Parag had a lot to say, so for this episode, we let things run a little longer than normal. I started off by asking him to set the stage by offering a quick overview of the ASEAN region and its appeal.
ASEAN stands for Association of Southeast Asian Nations. It's 10 countries of Southeast Asia, stretching from Myanmar through Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, the Philippines, Singapore, Malaysia, Cambodia, Laos, and so forth. So this is a cluster of countries that border each other, except for the island nations of the Philippines and Indonesia. It's a very, obviously, historically rich, civilizationally diverse region. From a geopolitical and economic standpoint, it is one of the absolute fundamental pillars of the entire world economy, as well as the Asian economy. Let me give you some headline figures here, right? China is obviously the largest economy in the region, the GDP in PPP terms nearing $18-19 trillion. Japan is number two, somewhere behind, you know, $8-9 trillion or a little bit less in US dollar terms. India is catching up to Japan. The GDP of Southeast Asia, right, ASEAN, is already $2.6 trillion. It's larger than India's GDP, but with half the population of India. There are only 700 million people in Southeast Asia. And here's one that's very important for those of us who are looking at the US-China trade war and those kinds of dynamics. Southeast Asia gets more foreign investment every single year, right? That's more new fresh capital, greenfield investment, factories, job creation, export-driven manufacturing growth, all that sort of stuff. There's more of that foreign capital coming into Southeast Asia than into China. And that's been true since 2015, 2016, 2017. It's always going to be true. And the reason has a lot to do with age, right? This is one of the youngest regions of the world, right? The median age is below 30, whereas in China, it's well above 40. Right. With one exception, Thailand. Thailand has a median age that's in the low 40s.
Does it also have anything to do with market accessibility?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, when we think about market access, you know, a lot of companies have had all their eggs in the China basket for a long time. China has been synonymous with Asia for many companies. But now there's a realization, of course, it's hard to do business in China. The domestic companies are rising very quickly up the value chain and competing directly with foreign, titans. And of course, these are more open political economies. These are democratic societies. There's been foreign investment liberalization, much more competitive. What's interesting is the tech sector, the American tech sector, the Facebooks, Googles, and LinkedIns, and so forth, they've been in this region all the whole time. Because of course, they never really had that access to China. So they've had their footprint here in Singapore for a very long time. They're growing like crazy in this region, hiring, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of new people every couple of years to service the growth trajectory of this region. Again, another testament to how important ASEAN is for the world economy.
But a lot of those companies struggled for quite a while too. I mean, they kind of went sideways because they are fragmented markets. There's not that large homogenous marketplace. So they've got to address different regulatory environments, different kind of wants and needs in the different markets. So it hasn't been entirely easy until recently. But like you rightly point out, it is starting to move now.
Well, it is amazing. You know, there's an irony too. Digitization and digital companies are the solution to the problem that they are themselves facing, right? Fragmented markets. Well, you need fintech platforms that harmonized currency trading across economies. You need cloud services so that there's seamless sharing of information. And airlines have been part of it. Air Asia, I like to tell, Tony Fernandez loves it when I say this. He's the CEO and founder of Air Asia. I say, you know, you're the best ambassador for ASEAN, right? Because he's the one who created a low-cost airline that gets 700 million people affordably, you know, moving around seamlessly across each other's countries. So the digital industry, the financial sector can play a very, very large role in the trade finance, in the fintech, and the others that smooth the liquidity that's going to enhance the economic growth of this region even further.
So technology and the internet industries are the ones which are allowing for integration for the first time and creating this acceleration.
You know, we see it, for example, in the ever important ride sharing industry, right? You'll have foreign investors come in, like SoftBank out of Japan and so forth, Tencent. So whether it's mobile apps, WeChat, or whether it is Grab, the ride sharing service, with the capital investment coming from everywhere in the world, including of course from local financing from the Singapore government, sovereign wealth funds, and so on, they quickly expand all across the region. So you have again this seamlessness. You know, you've got your, to take a simple retail example, you've got your credit card data from one country, your home country, stored in the app, but when you travel to another country, you can use it there too. Obviously, for people who've used Uber all this time, we're accustomed to that, but now you have the indigenous versions of that coming up across the region. And of course, it's not just ride sharing. It's mobile payments. It's all of the convenient services that one sort of takes for granted in other parts of the world that are overcoming the sort of frictions. I don't want to discount the role of government. It's taken a long time to get to this point, but the ASEAN countries have legislated free labor mobility across their borders. Again, 700 million people moving around. And I think what an important antidote to the narrative that this is a world of walls and borders and populism. That's the exact opposite of what is happening here in this region. And there's a lot more people who live here than live over in the US or in Europe.
Yet there still are some resistance. I mean, the idea of ASEAN integration has been bandied about a lot, creating a trading bloc, creating bilateral, multilateral arrangements to help for free flow of labor, for instance, which is a very sensitive subject for many of these developing markets. Governments, and obviously currency alignment is something that is always sensitive politically. So there's still a long way to go and more that can be done, and not a lot of movement towards that. Am I right?
Well, yes and no. So the most important thing is to not look at ASEAN through a European lens, to expect that there's some linear pattern where countries, you know, bring down their borders, integrate their economies, move towards supranational institutions like a European Commission and a European Court of Justice, a common currency, the Eurozone. That's not going to happen here. The diversity in this region, just linguistically, historically, ethnically, is umpteen times more than Western civilization, right?
More complicated.
Way more complicated, right? Remember, Indonesian civilization, Burmese civilization, Indian civilization, and so on, and Thai civilization, Vietnamese, Chinese. These are entirely unique civilizations. They have mutually unintelligible languages. They don't share even religion to a large degree. So it's ridiculous to think that there is some end state like an Asian Union just because there is such a thing as the European Union. So we have to have different expectations about what's going to happen. There isn't going to be a common Asian currency, but they have what is called the benefits of late development, right? They get to leapfrog a little bit. You use fintech to create more liquidity across these existing currencies that are not going to disappear, right? Things like that. That's happening, you know, quite a bit in this region. So when you're looking for integration, don't look only at what governments do, although that's important. People think it's boring, but as I just said, it's extremely important when it comes to labor mobility, when it comes to bringing down regulatory barriers for foreign investment, stock exchanges that are allowing a lot more cross-country listings, much more seamless listings across regional stock exchanges, so you can raise capital around the region. That's also happened. That's not something that just falls from the sky, right? It's actually a true physical example of progress towards integration. So let's look at the good things that they have been doing, not the theoretical things that they haven't done and don't even plan to do.
Which have been perhaps imposed or anticipated by Western viewers who are just saying, well, if it happened in Europe, why couldn't it happen in Southeast Asia? You're saying that's just like, you know, get rid of it. Get rid of that notion.
It's literally apples and oranges, right? We have to appreciate ASEAN for ASEAN, Asia for Asia, right? They're going to go about it their own way.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest this episode is Dr. Parag Khanna, global thinker, strategist, author, and until recently, a research fellow at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. Let's get back to our conversation. I asked Parag to outline some of the key factors in favor of Southeast Asia's near-term prospects. For starters, he points to the current state of global capital markets and what he sees as a growing appetite for Southeast Asian currencies.
Let me start with a point about the fact that even though these are relatively small currencies, except for the RMB, what the benefit that a lot of Asian countries are experiencing today is that there's a huge global appetite for local currency debt, for local currency bonds. And the big shift between 25 years ago and today is that a country like Indonesia, Thailand, others can issue 15, 20-year debt in their own currencies, long-dated maturity, sovereign and corporate bonds, and a world that's awash in liquidity is going to buy it up. And that's providing them with an enormous lifeline and cushion to be able to invest. And the modernization that is happening at this breakneck pace around Asia today is to a large degree the result of the rising appetite for local currency debt rather than just US dollar debt, which costs them a whole lot more. Now, on top of that, we have the phenomenon of the family businesses, the private sector, the very rooted small and medium enterprises that constitute the backbone of Asian economies. You know, again, if we're coming from New York or London, we're used to a world of large, vertically integrated, publicly listed companies with, you know, a huge geographic latitude to offshore capital, to engage in transfer pricing and inversion, all of these kinds of things that Western companies do. But that's not the psychology of businesses in Asia, whether they are the large conglomerates like, you know, the Samsung type companies or Mitsubishi, or whether it is the hotel chains, you know, operated by tycoons or shipping companies or timber companies that constitute, again, the backbone of Asian economies. There's an expectation, a social expectation, a government expectation that they are a real pillar of governance and order. You know, they provide for the welfare of hundreds of thousands of employees across the region. You know, they are viewed as co-governors in a way of these societies. There's an honor and patriotism at stake in being local and being rooted.
So caretakers of the national well-being.
Absolutely. You know, and that is true in India very much. Think about the reputation of Indian tycoons, you know, those who run the Tata family, the Jinda family, the Birla family, the Ambani family. These people, you know, oh, the mega tycoons, the mega billionaires, the Mahindra family, they are as much household names in a country of 1.5 billion people in India as any politician is, right? So there's a huge expectation that they are going to be contributing to society.
But Parag, to be fair, to push back a little bit, there's been a fair share of exploitation by some of these very wealthy families as well, whether we're talking Indonesia, India, Malaysia, and elsewhere. It keeps popping up. I mean, so whereas they may be handed the mantle of protecting a protectorate of the nation, greed is greed, and people will exploit that. Where do you draw the line? You know, where is the general good being abused by families like this?
Well, you have to view these societies sort of evolutionary. My dad's first job ever was working for Tata, right? And he went to the factory town of Jamshedpur in eastern
India. This is India.
This is India. And Jamshedpur in eastern India is really known as Tata Town, right? The company Tata, the steel mills and refineries and other, you know, bricks and mortar work that went on there, cared for, again, hundreds of thousands and indirectly millions of people at a time in Indian history where the government didn't really do much of anything. It was an agrarian, feudalist, you know, quasi-socialist society. So that's the background we're coming from. So if along the way, and certainly true today, where you have a tremendous amount of corruption, right, you have, you know, very pliant political systems that can be rigged. But in these, you know, hard infrastructure areas, you know, these fixed investment areas where some kind of neutral, you know, competitive bidding process for tenders like you would expect to see in Germany, it's not really going to happen. You know, in countries, whether we're talking about Brazil and Mexico or whether you're talking about India or Indonesia, there's only a couple of companies that right now that can get the job done. So we would inherently look at such a situation as corrupt unless we take a little bit of time to appreciate the local context, which is that these are, you know, terribly underdeveloped countries coming from a state of affairs where you can't get around the fact that it's the brother of one of the founders founding military generals of the country in the post-independence years of the 1940s who came to control all of the agricultural land, or fill in the blank, all of the zinc mines or platinum mines or oil deposits. That's just a fact. And so, you know, as someone who studies, you know, political economic history, to me, this is just par for the course. What I hope for, and what's extremely important to maintain, the solidarity that many of these societies did enjoy at the time of this euphoric independence that they gained from the British and French empires in the 1940s and 50s, is that they stay along this path, you know, that they don't succumb to the temptations of global free market financial capitalism, you know, and lose the sort of that rooted sense that they have obligations to society and that they have to uplift all of these masses. And by the way, it's not that they're not cognizant of this, right? We're talking about a region where countries like Indonesia have more than 200 million people, India has over 1 billion people, you know. Leaders wake up every day and actually not worried about Donald Trump's tweets or trade war. Sort of, I've got hundreds of millions of people to care for and mouths to feed. And I actually have a lot of respect for the amount of effort it takes to govern these countries.
So it sounds like there's almost a culture of patronage where these large organizations or tycoons who've been granted concessions 50, 60, 70 years ago are now beholden to the population to kind of deliver to them certain benefits, whether it's jobs or distribution of other concessions. So there's a network and an infrastructure of relationship that's in place, because you did point out earlier that the makeup across many Southeast Asian countries is large numbers of SMEs and relatively few large vertically integrated corporations.
But now we are in a transitional phase. So it would be a very traditional view to think about the structure as really being so neatly sort of, you know, simple to characterize as that, because we're in a transition where these stock exchanges have grown massively, right? You know, between Shanghai and Hong Kong, Tokyo, Seoul, Singapore, you know, there's obviously a large number of listed companies. You have a huge amount of privatization going on. You have a lot of floating of capital to raise foreign investment to expand industries further. So, you know, these are not really just bricks and mortar economies anymore. They're both at the same time. And I think that's also very important. That's globalizing this region. And globalization is how you import foreign practices that relate to corporate governance, right? And having to manage much larger pools of capital in a way that's responsible, not just to family offices and family boards, but much more international, you know, sort of corporate boards and have that degree of accountability. So this region is going through a process of learning that right now. And I think, by the way, you know, for everyone out there who looks at the business opportunities in the region, privatization is a very big story in this region, because you've had 20 years since the Asian financial crisis. You know, very often in this period of time that we are in right now, people talk about the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis. Well, for this region, the financial crisis was 20 years ago, right? It was the 97-98 Asian financial crisis. What these countries have accomplished in the last 20 years, when they really had buried their heads in the sand, you know, where they took on far too much debt, when their currencies were in free fall, they've built up massive trade surpluses, currency reserves, moved towards floating exchange rates, have invested massively in infrastructure, kept their inflation under control, right? Brought their deficits down. Remarkable story of achievement. And they want to preserve that at all costs, which means that rather than simply bail out failing enterprises and so forth, they're encouraging privatization, right? They don't want to throw public money after bad private assets, right? They want to, they don't want to actually be bailing in from society and spending the people's hard-earned savings of the last generations on failing state assets. So there's a huge amount of privatization going on, and that's going to improve the quality of business even further.
But there's still this perpetuation of state-owned enterprises, whether Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, and there is a lot of waste continuing, and maybe it's just the resistance to the idea that the private sector could do it better, or the fact that certain individuals who receive concessions or support are reluctant to give it up. Which is it?
It's both, and it's neither. And it's a third thing as well, which is every bit as important, which is the desire to manage one's own economic transition in a way that is not shock therapy. That's not jarring, right? Because everyone remembers the example of post-Soviet Russia, right? Where state-owned industries collapse, everyone is unemployed. Meanwhile, you have hyperinflation. You know, the ruble has gone through the roof and no one can afford bread. That's not something that any wise Asian country would want to do. So again, just as we were talking about the legacy of patronage networks that date back to the families that inherited wealth in the early independence years, there's also the legacy of state-owned enterprises in many of these areas where really the government has been the only player doing a certain job, and therefore that is why it does it, just merely by inertia. Yes, there's vested interests embedded in that, and then there's, you know, public-private patronage networks that service that. There is a resistance to change, resistance to cede control through privatization. But let's remember, all of that is happening anyway. Airlines, banks, dairies, fisheries, farms, timber, all of that stuff is being privatized in a very big way across this region. So we cannot actually talk about Southeast Asia as if it is still a bunch of, you know, faceless tycoons behind eight layers of gates in their villas, right? That's not the reality of the region today. It is clearly coming out into the open a lot more.
Yeah, and it's just, so it's an evolutionary thing. It's like it will shift, it will change. And as private sector examples continue to prove themselves, governments, in your view, will continue to relinquish control over areas or resources that they once held to their own.
Yeah, and this is something that we see, quite frankly, in common with other parts of the world. Let's look at the what's happened in the transition in Western economies. You know, the great wealth owners today in the United States, for example, are no longer, you know, just industrialists, right? It's finance and tech, right? Well, actually, that's quite true here as well, right? It used to be just real estate and shipping and, you know, infrastructure and whatnot, you know, hotel tycoons were the richest people in the country. Now it's finance and tech, right? So, you know, that enormous amount of wealth generation through those two sectors in particular is A, not a surprise because of globalization, financial capitalism, the technology revolution. And that capital is being reinvested not in hotels and lumber yards, right, but in actual services economic areas, whether it's education, a sharing economy, all these things that are proliferating around the region.
Yeah, you're very bullish. I mean, this sounds to me like if I was a buyer, I'd be buying Southeast Asia right now because it feels like, you know, really 9 for 10, 10 for 10, everything's going in the right way. What are your concerns and what are some of the issues that pop up for you as you go through and do your work?
Let me just say there are periods of time when the stars align for every part of the world. So I'm not bullish because I'm like selling the region. I'm bullish simply because it's the fact that at this period of time, ASEAN or every region of the world has its right to experience that moment where the stars align. Let's remember that the United States experienced this in the post-war years, right? Coming out of the Depression, World War II, came the largest economy in the world, largest manufacturing center in the world, you know, all the wealth to build out national infrastructure and provide for a large employment base. The country in America became a superpower. Europe also had its period where it was able to afford being a welfare state, offering the higher standard of living to a very large number of people like no other part of the world did. Asia also has those stars objectively aligning today, right? So two areas of concern. One is self-inflicted wounds, right? And that is, of course, corruption, right? I mean, just look at what's been happening in Malaysia, right? And, in, you know, Vietnam, very slow to reform because it's still very much an authoritarian, not quite a communist society, but an authoritarian government for sure. That's not going to welcome genuine multi-party democracy anytime soon. So there's very little accountability, transparency, oversight. So you have the corruption, the mismanagement that's really been a great distraction in places like Malaysia and in Vietnam. In Thailand, you had a coup, except, you know, the bad guys were the democratically elected leaders from before, not the military. The military is getting kudos from the people for their management of the economy. In fact, there was a referendum just last year in Thailand, in which the people basically ratified the military's continuity in its role. Now, they did, in fact, just announce very recently that they're going to liberalize political party activity as of January of 2019. So it's a sign that they view themselves as caretakers. But let's be objective about this again. They're way better caretakers than the last two democratically elected governments of Thailand. But anyway, to answer your question, self-inflicted wounds are a problem. Let's remember, this is not the Middle East. There's no foreign invasion. There's no civil wars, right? It's mistakes that countries are making. But I'll tell you this as someone who lives here, you've spent decades in the region. Where have you seen such a daily striving and yearning to not repeat mistakes, to get things right, to not screw up for too long, you know? And I think that's that earnest kind of attitude that I see Asian leaders having across public and private sectors is very genuine right now.
Well, when there are screw-ups, the consequences are pretty severe. I mean, you know, it could be assassinations, could be coups, could be basically overturns of and this has been a while now. There's a period of, as you rightly point out, since the late 1990s, you know, 20 years of relative growth and stability, and things do feel to be coming together. But it's not like, you know, it's inconsequential.
Right. Or 80s and 90s. So even Asia's more corrupt democracies, like the Philippines, have been throwing out leaders since the Marcos regime, right? And let's bear in mind that when you look for democratic accountability, let's look at South Korea, where they've imprisoned their president, right? Yeah. So I think that you know, there is a top-down and a bottom-up. I have studied more the top-down regimes. You know, I've looked at long-term visionary technocratic leadership like Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. But I would also add that if you look at Asia's three largest democracies, which are India, Indonesia, and the Philippines, so by the way, that's 1.8 billion people in three countries in Asia's three largest democracies, they're all electing leaders like Modi in India, whose explicit platform is a long-term mandate of robust, welfare-oriented infrastructure investment, right? So there is a policy consensus around what countries need to do, and they're doing it, whether they're democracies or non-democracies. And so that distinction between did you have an election last year or not versus are you getting things done is something Asians are way more attuned to than we are in the West, because we've gotten really complacent. Right.
Yeah. Well, this is a really interesting point. So let's talk about that governance and the value placed on governance versus multi-party democracy. I think this is a really interesting topic. I mean, we're seeing rise of authoritarian governments all around the world. But in Asia, Modi and Duterte are two great examples, you know, India and Philippines, where democratically elected but very authoritarian, you know, viewpoints and methods. Yet their popularity is on the rise.
Right. So those happen to be the two most, according to public opinion surveys, the two most popular leaders on the planet Earth today are Narendra Modi and Rodrigo Duterte. Now, in the West, we caricature them as the sort of the Trumps of their own countries. We think of them as strong men who rule by decree. That's not true. These are multi-party democracies that have elections like every few months in different provinces, right? Modi is going through provincial elections, state elections, literally every few months, and he's on the ropes in quite a few of them. He's already suffered some pretty big setbacks. So let's not kid ourselves. India is a very awkward and poor democracy, but it is a democracy. He's very scared about next year's election. Let's be clear about that. And the same can happen in the Philippines. We all thought that Noynoy, who was Duterte's predecessor, would have a very long run. He only made it through one term, right? So that there is a real democracy there. Now, are these guys? But here's what I want to really explain: is that we view them as these kind of, you know, tyrannical, authoritarian strongmen, but that's just because they're tough. Let's not cheapen the meaning of a genuine authoritarianism. Authoritarianism is about absolutely violent, suppressive, mind control, and genuine one-party rule by fiat and decree. It would be very disingenuous and unfair to the people of India and the Philippines to disempower them by calling their countries authoritarian. And you obviously would also be saying that you think they're stupid, because obviously you're saying that they have no reason to have their leaders be popular. What you're missing, therefore, is why are these leaders popular? Because it comes down to governance. They're getting things done. They're tough on crime, right? We look at Duterte and we say, oh my God, this guy just admitted in a press conference that he's killed people and thrown a guy out of a helicopter. He's a bad guy. That's not something that I would condone. However, their point of view is, my God, our streets have been taken over by drug lords. We absolutely do need to find ways to turn the tide.
Well, that's where I was going to push back a little bit, because yes, I mean, some you say, well, they're democratic elected and the people like them and they're appreciated and they're getting things done, but there are civil rights and there are abuses of power and there are bypassing or circumventing the courts. And there are things that sometimes people feel they need to do. But you, as you rightly point out, Parag, that, you know, in Duterte is somebody who's recognized quite quickly that the Filipinos were just sick and tired of living in crime-infested, broken-down urban centers. Something had to be done, even if it was extreme. So I think there's a point here that you're making, but I certainly wouldn't, you know, claim that this isn't without some atrocities along the way.
Oh, absolutely. There are atrocities, and I never apologize for them. But I want to make something very clear when it comes to civil rights and political rights and economic rights and freedoms in these countries. By every single measure, these countries are improving in those characteristics at the same time that we are anecdotally pointing to the flaws and mistakes and overreach of those specific leaders, right? So in other words, voter participation in the Philippines, improving. Efficiency of the court system, improving. Delivery of public services, improving. Under even the previous government in the Philippines, which everyone loved, he was a very, you know, well-spoken, silver-tongued kind of, you know, technocratic darling, the Philippines didn't legislate a K through 12 curriculum. Duterte legislated a K through 12 curriculum. Now, I don't have a dog in any particular country's fight, right? But that's something that any smart government should have done. But while we're too busy looking at his extrajudicial killings, we neglected that, you know, this is a guy who's raising wages for construction workers, for teachers, for maids, right? He's passed an education reform that never existed in the country. And by the way, leaders, it's not the first time that leaders circumvented courts in that country. He's not doing something that isn't already standard practice.
But he's also politically savvy too. I mean, as we see in the United States, raising the minimum wage gets you votes, right?
It's also the right thing to do, you know, of course.
Could be. But at the same regard, we don't want to miss the point that, you know, in order to be able to get away with some things which feel authoritarian, you've got to basically give up something to get the support in order to keep calling yourself a democracy.
But again, I think, you know, the most important perspective to always take in these kinds of conversations is where was the country coming from? Right. Now, raising wages is a big improvement on handing out sacks of rice, because that's what used to happen and still happens in Thailand, India, and elsewhere when you want to get votes. Now, that's a crack high, right? That's a really short-term hit. Yes, people need a bag of rice, but you've bought their vote. But when you legislate a pay, a wage hike, right, that's legislated and locked in beyond just one election. So let's, you know, again, differentiate between sort of, you know, giving out handouts to the people on a one-off basis versus actually making legal changes that are truly welfare-oriented. And that's part of what is definitely happening in India. Look at the, you know, the guaranteed minimum wage, right to food, all of these kinds of things that Modi is doing. Why didn't previous, even socialist governments, didn't do these things in India? And you have a guy who we think of, we caricature as a right-wing Hindu nationalist ideologue doing them. I would prefer that he was not those things, right? I would prefer that he were just the kind of humble civil service technocrat raised from the provincial backgrounds that he has, where he did a very good job in the state of Gujarat, which is really one of the best run and you know, best governed states in India, and simply map that onto the national level. But let's remember that it's not just Modi who's turning India in this negative and divisive direction. It's that federal politics in India has been this awful, backbiting, feudal landscape. Let's remember the country of India. I don't want to go into too much political historical detail, but when India was founded in 1947, it had 14 states. Today it has 29. Do you think that just the same banal, apolitical skill set that helped you run a city is going to help you run a country when you've got 29 warring, feuding states that each want to, you know, steal as much of the pie as they can, and you've got to run that country? It changes you. It's not just you who changes it. So I have again appreciation for the good things that leaders do. I wish that they didn't do the bad things that they do. But most of all, as a traveler, because I live in these countries, I embed myself in them for stretches of time, I just appreciate where they're coming from.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is Parag Khanna, author of The Future is Asian, Commerce, Conflict, and Culture in the 21st Century. More in a moment.
Inside Asia is supported in part by Black Marketing, the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing agency, created and led by the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing masterclass instructor, entrepreneur, and best-selling author, Chris J. Reed. Black Marketing is an award-winning, independent, boutique B2B marketing consultancy that specializes in enabling you to achieve your business objectives through LinkedIn. Learn more at www.blackmarketing.com.
I'm Steve Stein. Let's get back to my guest, Parag Khanna. In his book, The Future is Asian, he points to Southeast Asia and its bid to become one integrated and flexible economic unit ready to capitalize on rising U.S.-China tensions.
there is so much commercial regional integration going on. Again, whether it's ride sharing apps or supply chains for automobile parts, you know, right now, countries like Bangladesh and Cambodia and Myanmar are getting really hot for foreign investors who are moving their factory work out of China. And they're literally going into these tiny, tiny countries because it is such a borderless region now.
Yeah. And so also to bypass these brewing trade issues, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. So this region is winning massively from the trade arbitrage effect. Again, not only because of younger population and lower wages, but also because it has is participating in a lot of free trade agreements like TPP, like the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So being open economies that are trade-oriented is serving this region very well. Again, that's one of the factors that's part of this sweet spot and alignment of the stars in this region. So in answering your question, it's not that I'm sort of am all about, you know, all in with Myanmar or yay Cambodia, you know, or, you know, let's all invest in Mongolia. You know, people have been talking about Indonesia as this sleeping dragon for a very long time, and it's like yet to wake up, right? You know, only the island of Java is a functional economy in Indonesia. It has less than half the population of the country, but it's a tiny island with 100 million people. There's a lot of action there. Without a doubt, I would say Java is going to have its high-speed rail from Jakarta to Bandung, for example, in the coming 10, 15 years. There'll be a lot of dynamism there. But look at, you know, we're sitting here in Singapore, just across the very narrow Strait of Malacca is Sumatra, largest Indonesian island, 50 million people, fourth world level of development, not even third world, right? Completely backwards, right? No one has done anything with it to really develop and modernize it. Is that a place where people should be investing and developing? Absolutely, right? And there's many Sumatra-like geographies in this region. Now, what my hope, of course, is that we don't just go in with old paradigms and exploit these places and, you know, tear down their forests, right? Sustainably approaching these regions could lead to a whole new set of economic activities, from retirement communities and ecotourism to sustainable agriculture and so forth. They could be providing a lot more, you know, food for the region and other products and services in a sustainable way. And I hope that we'll apply the latest thinking and models to these places. And that's also part of the advantage of late development that this region is going through, Myanmar being a great example. No one had mobile phones there 10 years ago, but along came Samsung, and now pretty much everyone has one, right? Mm-hmm. So you can go from zero to 100 very, very fast.
You know, I asked you earlier what were some of your concerns. You know, let me throw out one of mine, environmental contamination. Right. I think because of Asia has served as kind of the manufacturing base for the rest of the world, whether it's China, Southeast Asia, and elsewhere, there's been lots of environmental destruction. And urbanization is just straining everywhere. I mean, look at the city of Jakarta. It's sinking. Water tables are falling. You know, sanitation systems are collapsing. There's some big, and there's some health-related issues that come with this. This is happening across the region. Does it concern you the same way?
Environmental stress is an unprecedented challenge in this region because you have 5 billion people across Asia and 4 billion people just in East and Southeast Asia. So, you know, the planet has never experienced this massive, crushing mass of humanity literally weighing down cities. And as groundwater is depleted, subsidence occurs and cities are sinking. You have sea levels rising in the equatorial latitudes at the same time. So there are huge challenges that are not around the corner. They're here today. The Mekong River, you know, the damming of the Mekong for hydropower production by China, the simultaneously pollution, industrial pollution of major rivers from China on down through the Mekong. All of that is hitting this region very, very hard. It's affecting agricultural cycles. It's definitely affecting livelihoods for tens of millions of people. So every one of those is an issue, and every one of them requires, again, the governments to commit a lot more resources to adaptation, climate adaptation, social adaptation, resilience, new infrastructure, rather than on fighting with each other, right? And so fortunately, as much as, because there is such a heavy focus on these factors, social resilience in the face of environmental stress, you see a lot more budget allocation going towards those issues. Jakarta is building a seawall, you know, all sorts of things like that are going on. So, you know, I think what's critical to remember, and I don't want to be complacent about this because World War III could break out at any minute, but this region has been so focused on economic and social progress that fortunately the major conflict scenarios are not one of the things that I am as worried about as other people are. Again, in our traditional, in our Western media, you know, we see warships and jets skirmishing in the South China Sea, and we say, uh-oh, this is World War III coming, and the U.S. and China are going to have some accidental, inadvertent escalation and crisis, and there's going to be war. That could happen. But let's ask why it hasn't happened yet. In the last 20 years that these countries have been having rivalries for centuries, actually, but particularly the last 20 years, why? It's because they've all realized that they've got to put those disputes aside, and they've got to focus on peaceful economic and diplomatic integration, and they're doing it.
This is Inside Asia, and you're listening to my conversation with Parag Khanna, global thinker, strategist, and commentator. As much as Parag feels that China dominates the story of emerging Asia, there's no avoiding the Middle Kingdom's evident move to stake out a bigger position on the world stage. While parts of Asia and the West interpret this as expansionist, Parag feels China's intentions are largely misunderstood. Take the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, for instance, a global infrastructure initiative that makes the post-World War II Marshall Plan look like a single-city housing project. With close to $1 trillion earmarked for the build-out of roads, bridges, and ports, China sees its plan as a way of interconnecting its economy with those of its neighbors. The U.S. sees it as a hegemonic move to seize land and power. Whether born of good intentions or not, the BRI has become a magnet for controversy. Khanna sees more promise than peril in the Chinese plan.
The real reason China is doing Belt and Road is because of the Malacca Trap. Again, we're sitting right here exactly 2 kilometers from the Straits of Malacca. The Malacca Trap is one of the most ancient, if you will, phenomena or principles of geopolitics. It's the recognition. Most of East Asia's energy imports from the Persian Gulf, from Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, UAE, flow through across the Indian Ocean and through the Straits of Malacca. So 80% of China, South Korea, Japan, it's their problem too. It's not just China, are very concerned about this choke point of the Straits of Malacca. All those tankers, what happens if there's a disruption there? They're going to run out of oil, right? So the purpose of Belt and Road is actually to access Caspian Sea oil and gas and Middle Eastern Persian Gulf oil and gas over land through pipelines and other kinds of corridors. And also there's an Arctic Belt and Road, by the way, because of the thawing of the Arctic, the melting of the Arctic ice sheet. There's a huge investment in getting Russian and Norwegian oil and gas over to East Asia through the Bering Strait. So the Belt and Road is actually all about logistical resilience. It's not an imperial hegemonic plot. Remember that if the Soviet Union still existed, there wouldn't be a Belt and Road. So China accidentally found itself 27 years ago in a situation where the Soviet Union collapsed, and suddenly it borders more of these former Soviet republics in Central Asia than even Russia does. That's not something China caused. China did not bring down the Soviet Union, right? The Western alliance did, and it itself brought itself down. Right. So a lot of people look at China as a country having a 1,000-year plan and a hegemonic vision and so forth. That's not at all true. It's actually just rolling with the punches, and it's taking its massive, obviously, currency reserves and surpluses and excess capacity and exporting it onto its neighbors in order to make them into more efficient passageways for trade and commerce.
But the Chinese are pragmatists. I mean, the mandate of heaven is dependent on the ability of these governments to continue to provide for their people, to continue to grow at the same rates, and make sure that they actually raise the quality of life for people in China. The feeling must be, I mean, why would you do China 2025 and Belt and Road and everything else unless you felt you needed this external expansion in order to drive the wealth in your own country?
What you need the external sort of infrastructural expansion for, what you need Belt and Road for, is to efficiently bring in the oil, gas, minerals, food to feed that population so that it remains stable, right?
So it is in their own interest, albeit others will benefit from it, is your point.
Others will, in an auxiliary way, in an incidental way, benefit. But China is not doing this to be benevolent. It's doing this to avoid the Malacca Trap, as I said. It's doing it to maintain its own economic stability. Along the way, this is very good for Pakistan. This is very good for Kazakhstan. This is very good for Mongolia. This is very good for Russia. right? All of these countries are getting new infrastructure. They control it. They own most of it, right? A lot of jobs have been created in their economies. They're, and some of them had very high debt to China before Belt and Road began, and now their debt goes up. But the sort of, you know, dirty secret that all economists know is that there's good debt and there's bad debt. You don't grow without debt, right? The question is, what do you do with it? Is it infrastructure that creates jobs and is a platform for growth and economic diversification? Or is it just, you know, piles of corruption, right? And the, in the Belt and Road case, the answer is much more the former. It's good debt. You have to remember, again, when you're talking about a country like Pakistan, this country and many others in the region, their populations have tripled since independence. How many new roads, highways, railways, schools, hospitals, hydroelectric dams, electricity grids have been built in Pakistan in the last 70 years? I'll tell you, zero. Yeah. And their population has tripled. There's power shortages every single day, right? So you have to, again, appreciate Belt and Road is what these countries desperately need. And I'm glad they're pushing back. It's a reminder that this is not a neo-colonial age.
That's Parag Khanna, strategist, thinker, and author of the newly released book, The Future is Asian: Commerce, Conflict, and Culture in the 21st Century. Khanna is skilled and thorough in his analysis of Asia, so there's some risk in attempting to wrap up and simplify all he's just said. But here it goes anyway. Sit with Parag and listen to him regale you on all that Asia has to offer, and his optimism grows infectious. He brings deep knowledge to the table and makes a sound case for Asia's prospective rise. And to be honest, who wouldn't want Southeast Asia and Asia overall to succeed? If all goes well, billions of people will benefit, lives and incomes will change for the better, and there's the distinct possibility that Asia's economic prowess could mute the effects of the next global economic downturn. That's if all goes well. Khanna is certain, maybe too certain, that potential pitfalls can be addressed and averted. Asian businesses, he says, will adapt their traditional, paternalistic, state-bound cultures to modern circumstances and embrace, over time, global standards of accountability. Diverse and striving nations will avoid armed conflict because tightly linked supply chains and self-interest make fighting one another irrational. Governments, he suggests, will act to stave off the devastating environmental side effects of economic and population growth, and it won't matter if those governments fit Western notions of propriety, at least in the short to medium term, since they're focused on delivering goods and services for their constituents. Even China, says Khanna, will prove a benevolent partner to its Asian neighbors, so nothing to worry about. All is good, right? It's an attractive vision and one, no doubt, that all Asian nations would like to project to the rest of the world in the era of creeping suspicion. Alas, as recent events have proven, governments don't always act rationally. Trump, Brexit, climate change denial, need I say more? What one day feels like a reasonable and progressive set of national plans and promises can easily go pear-shaped when threats, perceived or not, descend upon the public psyche. The other question speaks to the ultimate price of economic growth and progress. As the Western world has shown us, it's not enough to create conditions for capitalism to thrive. There are consequences, and it goes by many names: environmental degradation, income inequality, social unrest, and plutocracy. I'm not begrudging capitalism, but certainly Asia can learn from the excesses of the West, particularly at a time when technology holds promise of addressing some of the biggest challenges of our day. Then there's that thorny question of authoritarianism. Democracies are messy, as we've learned in conversations with previous Inside Asia guests. In order for Asia to grow and thrive on the trajectory envisioned, to what degree might personal freedoms and political liberties be curtailed? So what's the way forward on this? Embrace the positive vision of a burgeoning Asian moment and put hope before fear in investment, business, and strategic decision-making? Or stick with the prevailing Western narrative of an Asia that faces mounting debt-fueled environmental and geopolitical headwinds? A bit of both, perhaps? What do you think? Leave us a comment, download the episode, or better yet, reach us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. We promise to respond responsibly. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.
Inside Asia is supported in part by Black Marketing, the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing agency, created and led by the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing masterclass instructor, entrepreneur, and best-selling author, Chris J. Reed. Black Marketing is an award-winning, independent, boutique B2B marketing consultancy that specializes in enabling you to achieve your business objectives through LinkedIn. Learn more at www.blackmarketing.com.